It's WFMP LP Forward Radio, Louisville, Kentucky. Have you donated, friends? I'm just asking because I don't know if you know, but this whole thing doesn't happen for free. Like, we gotta run a radio station. Think about it. Welcome to Critical Thinking for Everyone!
You have just tuned in to your favorite hour of the week.
This is a fine hour, I think. It's an excellent one.
It is an excellent hour. We call it Critical Thinking for Everyone.
Hour.
It's our hour.
It is. It's our hour, but it's also your hour.
Very good. Very good. You can see that we, or hear that we are feeling punchy this week.
And that we are nerds.
Totally.
Yeah.
I'm Patty Payet. I'm one of the co-hosts.
And I am the other nerd, Brian Barnes. Welcome to our show.
Welcome to our show.
We're here to educate about critical thinking. We're going to try to do it in some fun ways. Sometimes it's going to get a little dense, but we're going to try to keep it light. And we appreciate it if you would just, I don't know, listen and think along with us, maybe, if you can. I mean, you got to drive your car and everything, but
right. Maybe,
you know, maybe you spend a little bit of time this hour kind of trying to soak some of this stuff up, you know, as we do. And I don't know. I guess the thing is that we are doing this show because we think that these ideas are actually useful for people's lives and that they improve people's lives. But that means that you have to get the ideas into your head. Like, right? I mean, you have to get them first. And so the way to do that probably is to listen. I don't know.
And
it's
to
radio.
Think it through, as you said. Think it through along with us.
You have to, yeah.
Yeah, because at this show, we're always learning as we go.
Yep.
And so we invite you to come along with the journey with us. And this particular show is a special one. They're all special in their own way, though.
I mean,
right?
I felt just momentarily a little bad for all the other shows.
We love you, all shows. We love all, yes. It's like all of our children.
If other shows are listening, it's fine. We think you're great.
We do think you're great. And in fact, we think you're so great that today we have decided that we are going to review some of our favorite concepts from 2018.
Oh, fantastic. That sounds like fun because we really liked those concepts in 2018. Wait a minute. It's still 2018.
I know it is. I'm a little bit premature on this.
You're a little premature on
this. But there's a method to my madness.
Ooh.
Next week, we are bringing a special guest into the studio, Dr. Gabe Hoffman.
Oh, yeah, man. Gabe Hoffman. She's fantastic.
Yeah, and then we slide right into the holiday season.
Mm-hmm.
And so who knows what's going to be coming up there. So I thought, let's plan ahead. Even though it's just the end of November, early December, our show has been on just a little bit over a year.
Wow.
So I thought this was a perfect time to do like a little retrospective.
And here we are.
Here we are.
All right.
Retrospect with us.
All right. Please. Yes. Come along and retrospect.
Okay. So now when I wrote this list and proposed it to you, Brian, earlier this week,
yep.
I need to acknowledge that there was not I did not re-listen to every single show this year, right? Instead, I thought, just, you know, like, what were the things that came to mind that really stuck with me? And these may or may not have stuck with you, but
right.
We'll see.
And at some point in the future, I might do a show with concepts that I care about, but this is Patty's show.
Oh, ouch.
No, we both have cared about these concepts.
Yes.
These are just the ones that Patty came up with.
In fact, some of these, I'm like, wow, I'm really going to have to let Brian talk about that because that is not my expertise there. So.
They're your concept.
All right. So these are 10, not in any special order. Okay.
10. I'm
10
with you on that.
Ideas.
Okay. But so, so just another thing to say, you suggested that these ideas not be part of our normal critical thinking bag, which is ye old Paul Elder framework.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that right?
Yes and no.
These are not Paul Elder, explicit Paul Elder concepts. So these are not, like, if you're in a critical thinking class or something, these might not be kind of the standard vocabulary you would encounter there in this particular episode.
Yes, thank you for clarifying that. The critical thinking concepts from the Paul Elder approach, which is what the framework that we use often, not always, but often, are sort of part and parcel of everything we talk about. And then these concepts are actually sort of, I would describe them as featured ideas.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay. Uh-huh,
okay?
Uh-huh.
Not the tried and true, necessarily.
Roger that.
All right, so the first one I want to talk about is this idea of humor and critical thinking.
Oh, man, that's been part of the show since the beginning.
I know. And so I want us to talk a little bit about why do we think humor and jokes can be helpful in helping us think critically. What was, because this was really your thing.
Yeah, it was.
Talk about that.
Well, so the idea was that jokes are often funny because there's something unexpected in them, right? So, for example, I might be surprised by a joke, right? I might not. Often we say we don't see the punchline coming.
Right.
Right? And it's that element of surprise when I started looking, sort of just thinking about jokes, it occurred to me that in a great many cases, not in every case, I think we've looked at that, but in a great many cases, the reason why the joke is funny hinges on me not really fully understanding how the person telling the joke is interpreting the words in the joke.
Okay.
So that's not necessarily something that I was able to figure out. And then I'm surprised because if it's a good joke, I see how you could have interpreted it like that, but you wouldn't normally say, mm-hmm. and that's why it's funny. And so I thought, well, there's a little bit of thinking in there
mm-hmm.
that, oh, man, almost everybody is doing implicitly.
Meaning?
The interpreting of the joke. A good joke, we get caught up in the joke.
Right.
Right? I mean, the person listening to the joke gets caught up in it. And part of the craft of telling the joke involves delivering the punchline in such a way that you don't give it away at the wrong time. Right? And so you, in a certain way, the person who's telling the joke is manipulating the person who's hearing the joke.
Right.
And if you're the person hearing the joke, you can learn to unpack that. And you can know that, for example, there's a joke coming. And you can get some sense of how, if this is a joke, how the information might be misinterpreted intentionally in order to lead to the punchline. Some people are quite good at this. Angie,
like
for example.
Figuring out the punchline.
Yep, figuring out the punchline, able to tell the joke maybe in a way that's even funnier than the joke, right?
Got
because
it.
Because they understand the logic of the
right.
joke.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
And so I thought, okay, so this is something that I literally know people are able to do and in real time. So if Angie, for example, can do it in real time, my friend Dave also can do this in real time. Well, and these are people like, you probably know some people like this, like they're watching the TV shows and they come up with the funny line before
and
people say stuff like, oh, you could write this stuff, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the kind of thinking because they understand the logic of how this is being constructed.
Right.
So it's easy. And that's something that some of us who are not doing it in real time could very easily slow down and make explicit.
Mm.
And then we can look at the thinking that goes into that in a much more explicit way because we have the time to do it. That's a type of analysis that anybody driving in the car could replicate.
Hmm.
That's a kind of analysis that ends up getting us to talk about jokes afterward and retell the jokes and then maybe think about, maybe talk about why we thought it was funny or why maybe it didn't hit us as funny.
Hmm.
That's where we're doing self-reflection. We're using some standards to evaluate our own response and maybe evaluate the joke itself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We're doing some process of analysis. all of that happens at a minimum. And we might be doing other things, like we might be confronting or maybe even overlooking our own unconscious biases.
Right.
I mean, there are all sorts of things that have popped up when we've been talking about jokes that I didn't necessarily anticipate that have been positive. But I think those couple of things that I just mentioned, jokes are non-threatening. And so I think if they can get us to do all that stuff just from a joke and a bunch of joke books that we pulled out, then I think that that's worthwhile to get people to think about their thinking about the joke, because that's what we're supposed to be doing for any content. And if I can do it about jokes, then I can do it about the news, right? Then I can do it about,
you know, conversations I'm having with people where, like in a joke, we looked at how jokes often rely on stereotypes about, you know, certain cultural or social stereotypes. And, you know, and you're like, oh, you know, like, oh, I get it. You know, that guy's been married forever and he's, you know, henpecked or whatever, right? There's that. So so we talked a lot about that and how jokes subvert assumptions and have this verbal mental sleight of hand.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
And so jokes. Now, we haven't been using jokes recently.
We haven't. And we've actually, it's one of the few things that our audience has called for us to return
to. Oh, really? I didn't. You've been hearing that from our fans?
Yeah. I think we got a couple of comments about how
comments?
Much people like the jokes.
Okay.
And then we've gotten at least one comment that I remember about, you know, didn't hear a joke, wish you'd tell a joke kind of thing.
Okay, so. Well then 2019, I think we need to resolve to bring back some humor into jokes into the show.
We need to. We might even need to resolve to organize the show a little bit more explicitly such that the humor part is always kind of in the same place.
Okay.
Maybe.
All
right. So, I mean, if we have people listening to the show, maybe they'll know where to find it then and they can go and get that. But I just want to point out that what we're talking about right now with regard to humor is one aspect, but there's another aspect of this that we just touched on but we didn't necessarily talk about, and that is the way that I'm manipulated by the humorist.
Oh.
It's benign enough, right?
Right.
But one of the powerful things about humor is that it has the opportunity, because of what it is, because it's intended to be comedic, it has a certain license to subvert the way we normally see things. And that's not to say that humor always tells untruths. Maybe in a lot of cases, quite the opposite. But humor is a way for us to sort of re-examine the truth or reinterpret the truth or the reality of what we see. And so because of that, it's necessarily a manipulation.
Or benign one, as you said.
Maybe.
But it creates its own world. It creates this artificial tension that is released by the punchline.
And so the person who is doing that manipulation is, among other things, practicing sophistry.
Okay. All right. We're going to have to add sophistry onto our list of concepts. Can we segue into that one, please?
Well, sure.
That's like, you know, I said to Brian earlier this year, the worst thing that Brian Barnes can call you, anyone out there, is a sophist. That is like the...
Man, and the whole place is jam-packed with them. It's just ridiculous.
All right.
So remind the good people, what is
a sophist?
Okay. You tell us.
All right. Here's what I have learned, gleaned from you.
Oh, you know this before.
The sophist. Well, I knew it somewhat, but you really helped me appreciate.
All
so
right.
Sophist is the thinker who is engaged in conversation or an argument or even marshaling evidence in ways that are really about them winning a point or a conversation and that aren't really about engaging in fair mind, what we call fair-minded dialogue or thinking, where you're really trying to get at the truth or you're really trying to look fairly at different points of view. The sophist is interested in his or her point of view and how to make that the dominant or right, quote unquote, perspective, even if it's inaccurate. Do you think that's a accurate way to describe?
You were paying attention.
I was.
I didn't know. Sometimes I think this stuff just goes right past all of us. No, really though, the sophist is
is a thinker that any of us could be.
Ooh, ouch.
I mean, all of us to some degrees practice sophistry because we do have our own interests in mind. We try to persuade people of things that we want. Sometimes the overwhelming majority of us are sometimes manipulative, sometimes deceptive, right? And so that's why I think looking at jokes is a nice way to just introduce the notion that I could be manipulated. Manipulated in this sense into laughing at something that normally maybe I would not have found funny.
Right.
But then what happens? Let's take a step up from that. Who also manipulates in a benign way, but a little more so. Any ideas?
Who?
What other group?
What other group?
Not jokesters.
Politicians?
It's too high up the food chain.
Too high up.
There are stakes there.
Oh, marketers.
Now stakes there too. Money, money.
Whoa, who are you thinking?
Magicians.
Right, magicians.
Card tricks.
Yeah,
sleight of hand.
They're distracting you. And having you look over here like a sophist, right? Look at this point, but don't even think about what I'm really doing.
Oh, it's exactly it. I mean, they're intentional methods because they practice. I mean, they're not really using magic. I hate to spoil that for anyone who's listening, but welcome to the show. Yeah, I mean, they're highly trained technicians, and I say trained in the sense that they practice this card trick, this coin trick, this thing they do with a box or whatever. They practice it over and over and over to the point where it makes it look like it's something other than what it is. There's a technique for that. And really, we all know that.
Yeah.
But sometimes we get so impressed, particularly by up-close magic.
Mm.
If you're in Louisville and you want to check out some awesome up-close magic, Manny the Magician.
Really?
He's at Ramsey's on Friday and Saturday night. Ramsey's Cafe. He's so good, he'll blow your mind.
Wow.
He'll blow your mind. Wow. And he works for tips, and he goes around to the tables. I don't know. He's pretty old now, so you might want to go up to him. He's not as mobile as he once was, but he has a cart, and he had a stroke recently.
Oh.
This is the thing about magic. Guy had a stroke recently. He's an elderly man, sweet as can be, Manny the Magician here in Louisville. But this guy, he's still performing on Friday and Saturday nights at the restaurant, Ramsey's Cafe on Bardstown Road, and he comes up and he tells you the story. He tells you the story about his stroke. And I mean, his family comes and gets him. It's no joke.
Wow.
He really was out for a while because he was, very ill, right? And he tells you about his wife who recently is deceased, and he tells you about this stuff, and he tells you this amazing story, and then he does his magic trick while he's telling you the story, and it absolutely is it's impressive. Up
really?
Close, I've not
really?
Yet seen exactly how he does this
You haven't
thing.
Figured out his sophistry, so to speak?
Well, I've looked at his methods a lot, and for a lot of his tricks, I see where he did what he did.
Oh.
But this one is, whoa! It is the one that he's doing now. He's only doing one that I've seen right now. And it is absolutely incredible.
Wow.
And what can you say about that? Well, I mean, the training goes deep. Right? And so would it be the case for people, no offense to Manny whatsoever, because he's not a sophist, but would it be the case for people who are doing intellectual sophistry, right? I mean, are they trying to get us to believe things, right, as a result of these critical thinking tools? And so that's what we've got to worry about with the sophist. The other thing we have to worry about is a lot of us are very comfortable justifying some degree of sophistry.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's also sophistry, our own sophistry.
We all do it.
Right, because we are naturally, as human beings, heavily vested in our own interests, in our own outcomes that we want, even if we tell ourselves, well, I'm being fair-minded. Of course, this is the outcome I want. Of course, this is the right answer.
Right.
Right. So we need to be aware of our own sophistry. We need to be aware of the ways in which we manipulate or try to manipulate conversations or situations toward our own ends.
So
sophistry, if Brian Bards calls you a sophist, you need to be careful.
And look, there's nothing wrong with magicians. There's nothing wrong with people telling jokes.
No.
The whole point is these are ways to see explicitly that you're being manipulated. And then there's, in both cases, there's a relatively strong invitation to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Whereas with political speeches, are we being manipulated? Yes. Is there an invitation to participate? And is there an explicit understanding that we're supposed to call out the ways we're being manipulated? No, none of that's true. But we probably should still do that. The news, same thing. Do we know we're being manipulated? Maybe. Do we know how to sort of confront that if we are? Maybe not. Right. But as a critical thinking issue, we ought to at least be aware that there are editors, producers, owners, all kinds of vested interests that are helping to shape what we see as news, and that's not trivial.
Yeah. So it's not like, wow, you know, I just need to make sure I don't get manipulated when I'm, you know, at the car dealership. No, this is, you don't want to get, as Carl Sagan says, bamboozled by the world that is constantly trying to convince you of certain truths that are not actually accurate.
Nope.
So that leads us into another interesting concept that we looked at this year.
What was that?
Which was about investigating provocative headlines and claims.
Oh, yeah. You're all about that.
What are some of the claims we investigated that we saw online in reputable news sources? What are some of them, the claims?
Well, we had the recent one about probably this thing flying through the universe or quite possibly or something like that is an alien probe.
That's right.
We had one really early on about chocolate
and red wine helps you live longer.
Which you know, we're still working on the evidence for that one. I'm trying.
Are you testing that one out?
I am testing that. I know that those don't fit with your dietary peccadillos, but yeah, I've got a couple.
Yeah, you're working on it. I'm so glad. Yeah. The other thing is we investigated that red wine versus exercise is
I see that you're investigating
beneficial.
That one.
Yes, I am.
That's good.
I am.
Yeah. I'm the control.
Yeah. So I love it. So what did we learn? So here's something I took away from that. So a couple things. One is when you see a headline that says something like, again, if this is online, you're looking at the news, you're on CNN, you're on Time.com, you're on Yahoo, whatever, The Guardian, you name it. And there is a headline that it makes a claim that makes you go, what? Or, huh?
Yeah.
You know, like red wine and chocolate's going to help me. So right there, it sort of like tweaked your, by sort of like subverting or sort of getting your attention by playing with an assumption or a wild claim that, that's sort of like what we call clickbait, you know, like, oh, what? Really? Red wine? So one way is just, first of all, to know that those headlines are shaped that way to try to get your attention. Oh, I'm being hooked. Mm-hmm. So right away you can be like, oh, you can feel like a fish with a hook in its mouth. Headline just hooked me. So that's one thing we need to be aware of, those headlines. The other thing is when you click on them, what did we learn about investigating those claims? Let's just use the red wine and chocolate one. What did we learn? What do you do once you click on that? And you're reading it and you're like, huh?
What do you do once you click on the claim?
Yeah.
Well, your pet thing is to read laterally and to click back.
Exactly. Really good. You're paying attention.
Well, you know, this is one thing I want to point out. When the vocabulary is presented to you so many times and with such frequency, then you do tend to pick this up. I mean, I wasn't trying to learn these terms, but I've just been sitting here on the other side of this microphone for like a year. And I keep hearing these terms, and she says what they are all the time if you go to SoundCloud and go back and listen to some episodes. So, I mean, this is something we talk about in critical thinking. Use consistent vocabulary. Mm. Be explicit about the terms you're trying to use. Be clear about the ways you're defining them and the examples. I mean, I've learned, you know, and we've done exercises on the radio. Have you been there for these exercises? We're going to do more in the upcoming year.
Yeah. Investigating claims. So as Brian said, you first of all, you look at the article and it says, oh, a study from University of California, Irvine has shown that, oh, and guess what? That study is going to be a hot link. What do you do? Click. You go, really? A study, huh? Right? And then you click on that. And then often, and it's been really surprising to me how quick access I can get to the actual journal article.
Yeah.
Sometimes it takes me to a summary or a press release about the study. Yeah. And then what do we find happens? Immediately when we start clicking back to look at more depth, we immediately see nuances. Oh, this claim is, this headline is way over. This is hyperbole. This is inflated. Actually, the claim is much more nuanced. The research was saying there's some promising evidence, right? More studies need to be made, right? So then we started actually, or I should say, I started actually reading these journal articles in fields that are not my expertise and had to really like challenge myself to try to understand them and started to go, wow, these, so actually when you click back to the sources, the original sources from, of, and you read laterally across, like to other, or laterally means you're saying, okay, well, what did Time Magazine say about this? Okay, let me look into that. What is the New York Times? Really? That's a probe? Well, let me see what the New York Times says about that alien probe, right? So you start to look at, and you start to see inconsistencies. You start to see different amounts of depth and nuance. So what I've learned is those claims are often, there's, if it's too good to be true, guess what? It is not true.
Right. Well, and I think one thing, too, that you know we haven't talked about necessarily or not maybe once or twice,
but
is something that's closely related to this that everyone really should think about is primary sources versus secondary sources.
Okay.
You know, I mean, the whole issue is if they're referring to some other source that they got their information from, they're at least a secondary source. I mean, we would classify them as in philosophy, I guess the humanities generally, as secondary sources, right? These aren't
the original study.
These aren't the original, right?
This isn't the original study.
And often in the media, they simply tell you about it, and so all you have is the secondary source. And the whole problem, you know, for sure in academia, this is pointed out repeatedly, or has been during my, you know, time, is that, you know, there are interpretations. The secondary sources always have their own voice. They always have an interpretive lens. They always are, you know, bringing some purpose, some assumptions.
Condensing, right?
They're condensing.
They're
highlighting areas that weren't necessarily highlighted in the original.
Right.
You know, and it's not to say that any of these things are inappropriate. It's just simply to say that the sense that you can get from looking at a secondary source about a certain primary source, what we call an original, could be really different from the sense that you would get from only looking at that primary source, or if you looked at that primary source independently of these other sources. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important that you do click back. It's really important that you go and seek out that study if it's not there. It's not enough just to have the information there. I saw someone posted something on Facebook about, oh, this recall of frozen vegetables. I went, what? Not only was it from 6 months ago, it was from the United Kingdom. I was like, wow, I don't have any of those vegetables.
You were like, that's the importance of clicking back.
The headlines had no information. Yeah. The little blurb article had none of that information. Wow. And then I was like, where is this? What's this news source? I've never heard of this before. I don't figure out why. But I mean, a lot of people up until that point anyway had at least just been sharing it and saying, hey, this is, you know, I'm sure people continue to do that. It didn't stop with me.
Right. So really going beyond the headline, really having a really attitude of, what's the evidence here, right? What, you know, that's just a good critical thinking move all the time.
Yep.
All the time.
Because we live in this soundbite society.
Yeah.
It's not enough just to take the idea.
Right, exactly. And so that leads us nicely to another concept. We did a whole show. You may not remember this. Maybe you do.
We did an entire show. You were there.
Dude, you were there. Oh. You were there. But I don't know. We did a lot of shows this year. We did like, what, 40-some shows so far this year?
Just because I looked at my college transcript once and didn't remember some of the classes on there at all.
At all.
Does not mean that I don't remember the content of this year's program.
Well, that's
but you could have
like
been talking to listeners, and if so, we don't believe you remember anything you say.
Well, it's funny you should bring up college because that has been a theme throughout this year. Is you have shared revealing anecdotes about your college years and how they developed you or not as a thinker.
I'll wait till we get to the Army years.
We're going chronologically, folks. So,
well, yeah, and I think, you know, you have too. You've shared a lot of personal anecdotes about yourself and about your interests and values and family and your own personal narrative. I think it's really important that we do that. You know, our mentors in critical thinking have also stressed that example. Everybody's a thinker. Everybody's living a life. The kinds of problems that I have are going to be in some ways relatable to problems that you have or that our listeners have. And so by sharing the examples and by taking other people's questions seriously about those examples, not only does it give me more insight into myself, which is grand, it also gives you more insight, you know, everybody else out there, into themselves, whether we're actually asking the questions or whether we're just observing the dialogue. It really is, you know, it really is helpful, I think, for all of us to spend a little time thinking about the decisions that we've made, going back and revisiting those and taking those apart. And this is not easy work. You know, a lot of people do this in therapy, and I've, you know, I've done it in therapy too. But I also think that being able to talk about these things openly and being able to sort of take responsibility for the things I've believed and said and done in a great many cases, and showing people that, you know, intellectual change in some regard is possible. Behavioral change in some regard is possible. Value changes in some regard, you know, is possible. And I think that people, if we're going to have a critical thinking path and if there's going to be something at the end of it, the process has to be one in which I have provoked and cultivated dynamic change within myself. So is that just theory? You know, it's not just theory. I mean, a lot of us have examples, and you have them too, about how the thinking part has been relevant and how it led to the success or failure of an enterprise and how that might be somehow relevant for the thinking of others. I mean, that's, for me, that's a good use of this time on the air, is to share the spaces where I've stubbed my critical thinking toe and just said, look, you all should look out for that.
I think that's very well said and very humble, intellectually humble.
Oh, thanks.
And
I've been humbled.
You've been humbled. So. Against your will.
You know, I mean, I don't want to get too personal on it, but let me just say the critical thinking work, and you've experienced this as well, the critical thinking work, if we just take it seriously, it causes us to self-reflect, and often it causes us to point out places to ourselves where we've done poor thinking and where we could improve that thinking. How much more the case when you have a highly motivated, highly skilled mentor in critical thinking, looking for questions to ask that are highly personal and highly relevant, all of which can be plumbed with the critical thinking tools. And of course, you know, I could have passed on any of those questions, I suppose. Maybe I even did. I don't know, in some cases, but it didn't stop questions from coming that were highly relevant and that were deeply personal. And when I felt like engaging with them, which is what it takes with critical thinking, you have to decide to do the engagement. Yeah. When I did that, it was always revealing, often painful, always transformative.
Fascinating.
I wish other people would have the experience.
Well, I need to call out an example that you gave earlier this year, which I was really stayed with me in terms of an example of your own intellectual humility.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay.
Let's see if I made it up.
Okay.
Go ahead.
See if you made it up. Okay. We were talking earlier this fall, we were talking about the critical thinking work that I've been doing at U of L for a long time, and we were talking about how I said, wow, in 2009, you were teaching classes on critical thinking. And when you actually elected to participate in my faculty learning community to learn about critical thinking, and yet you were teaching this, I said, wow, that shows a lot of intellectual humility on your part. And you said, actually, no, that wasn't the reason that you joined the learning community. Sure. It was because why?
Cash,
because there was cash incentive involved. And so, but here's the thing that really,
because not only the students are insecure in various important ways.
Yes.
Anyway, go ahead.
Anyway, so you said the money, and you said, I was like, wow, really? That's how you got involved with this project, was you were enticed by money. But then this is what you said. You said, and correct me if I'm wrong, that once you started to engage and really show up and listen to what I and my colleagues said about this approach to Paul Elder, approach to critical thinking, you said it actually caused you to pause and rethink a lot of your foundational assumptions about what critical thinking even is and what it looks like. And at that point, you had been working in critical thinking for years. And so I was like, and so rather than you just walking away going, well, this is BS, right? Like this, you know, I don't know if this is worth the money. It sounds like to me you stayed with that and you let it actually, as you said, transform the way you think. Am I being accurate?
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely accurate. It totally blew me away because I hadn't experienced it in any of my academic explorations of, you know, the philosophical disciplines around critical thinking, most of which in my training were based in logic, as I'd mentioned before, as opposed to any kind of other system, right? And I know that other systems in other disciplines have things they call critical thinking that aren't based in logic, but those didn't seem to me to be very robust for the kind of work I was doing in philosophy. And so when I came across this, I just really couldn't figure out why I hadn't seen it before, because it seemed very, very helpful and seemed very appropriate for the work, even at a graduate level. And then as I got into it more deeply, the suggestion was made to me that it's because it's been marginalized and there was a competition sort of for the status quo of critical thinking in this organization, and this method
approach.
Yeah, lost at some point and really became marginalized and has stayed marginalized. And I went, wow, that sounds pretty conspiratorial. And then the more I looked into it, the more I was like, wow, that they might be onto something. The more I looked into them, it's like, why doesn't anybody cite these people, but they still say the same things? Like, did nobody look? No, because some of it's verbatim. This stuff really gets marginalized in a big way, and I really don't know why. But it's because I do think it's quite useful, and I've said that on many occasions.
So. Yes, you have. So, why did that stick with me? Why did that example stick with me? Because I went, wow, I'm trying to imagine if I was invited into a conversation or a training on a topic that I prided myself on being an expert, and I went into it. Let's say I was motivated by money or glamour or stat, whatever reason, it was not really to be intellectually engaged. Okay, let's just say. And then I was confronted with all these ideas that really forced me to, again, think of an area that you pride yourself on really being a master of, or even like if someone said, hey, you've been a parent for 18 years, come to this workshop, we're going to teach you something, and I might be like, come on, I've been a parent successfully for, right, quote-unquote, successfully for 18 years. What could you teach me? And so what really stayed with me about that example was it really, the way you talked about it and its ability to transform your thinking, I thought you have to be willing to have your thinking transform.
Yeah.
In order to do that, this is this concept of permanent skepticism. If I'm going to be a true critical thinker and not a sophist, right, if I'm really going to work on my natural egocentrism and sophistry and really try to be a thoughtful, rigorous critical thinker, then I'm going to constantly be skeptical about knowing the truth about anything, about the perspective of people around me, about my ability, my quote-unquote expertise on a topic, about this politician and what I've known about him or her forever, and then I get new information. And so if I'm constantly skeptical or constantly saying, there are limits to what I know, and I can always know more about every single thing, then we become more open to learning and to increasing our depth of knowledge about the world around us and our own thinking.
Yeah, well,
is that true?
Yeah, it's great when we can find things that turn us on like that. I mean, for people who think, oh, wow, that just sounded crazy. I mean, I don't think so, because all of us at one point or another have been, well, maybe not all, I hate to overgeneralize, but a great number of us have been inspired by music. You know, something on the radio that we heard, some song became particularly important to us for some maybe short period of our lives.
Yeah.
You know, some of us are really inspired by music, and in some cases, the words in those songs prompt us to think through some things going on in our own lives or some ways we feel about some things. I mean, in an earlier age, poetry served that function as well, right? I mean, literature can serve that function,
right,
and art in all of its forms. But a lot of us just have listened to the radio and went, oh, yeah, Bon Jovi said, you know, or whatever you do. And I don't think people did that. But anyway, something like that, right? They took something out of an important song that they heard, right, on the radio and modeled something about their lives about it, whether they're, you know, more responsible or less responsible, or, you know, whether they relax more or care more about engagement, or whether they do something different with regard to their relationships. A lot of times it's because of a song. Well, if people are inspired to change because of something like that, or because of a story they read in a comic book, or because of a scene that they saw in a movie.
Or a radio show.
Or something they heard on the radio show, then certainly you could be inspired by looking into your own thinking and discovering what's there and deciding that maybe there's something that's worth, I don't know, studying about that, right? That maybe there's something there that's actually worth refining. And, I mean, a lot of us have the same ideas. We're inspired to physical fitness, for example.
I was exactly just thinking of that example.
Go ahead.
We have talked about that, you know, people, ourselves or people we know, our neighbors, our colleagues, or, you know, other people at the gym, they will make physical fitness and improving their strength or their flexibility or their, you know, ability to do any kind of physical feat. They will spend time out of their week. They will spend money for gym subscriptions.
Yep.
They will
special
get the special clothes.
Yep.
And run marathons and work toward improving. But how are in our culture, we don't seem to have a parallel commitment to how can I be a better thinker this week, right? What are my thinking goals this year? Where am I a good thinker? Where do I let my biases run free? How can I be more skeptical and be more open? We don't seem to have that cultural social conversation, do we?
No, we really don't. And that's something that I've started asking a lot of my students too, as a way of introducing you know, the courses that we're taking, right? Because I think that one of the explicit goals of taking courses is that my thinking would change in some regard. So the question is, you know, I have some other goals, right? Work goals that I've made explicit this year.
I've got maybe financial
goals that I've made explicit. I've got, you know, health goals, maybe other things. And then, you know, to what extent do I have thinking goals?
Seriously, does anyone out there say that they can have thinking goals? I mean,
maybe if they listen to the show, they're nerdy
maybe
enough.
Maybe. We want you to tell us.
You'd
on
have
Facebook.
To be a high-level nerd, but yes, please hit us up on Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, we both walk around with thinking goals kind of already in our head all the time because we are critical thinking nerds. But this is good stuff for everybody. It is for everybody, as we are constantly saying. So I think that's so interesting. How do we help people pay more attention, more energy, and have thinking goals? But you can't have thinking goals if you're not even aware and thinking about your own thinking, noticing where it's going well, noticing where it's taking you off track.
Right.
Boy, this is a lot of work.
Well, and I have to say, you know, if you think it's a lot of work, here's something that might help you cut some of the work out.
Yeah.
Certainly, Richard Paul, our mentor, used to say this a great deal to me in particular when I was trying to design workshops, professional workshops, and that kind of thing. If I'm not mistaken, this idea for him is taken from John Henry Newman, the 19th century educator. Yeah, well, it's a much longer passage, I think, in Newman, but I think the idea that is encapsulated for Richard was strive to do a few things well as opposed to doing many things poorly.
Okay.
Right. And so when there's a thing that happens for a lot of us in the modern world, which is we get overworked.
this semester, this last 4 month period, I've just been crushed.
Have you crushed under the weight of your own to-do list?
Work. It's not as bad as it was a year ago this
really?
Time. I've been making it better and better, but oh, dude, I still got caught, and it's been okay, but I'm a little behind my own deadlines, and I'm going to have to go in and, like, tell some students about this very story today and say, hey, you know, not all the grading's done just yet. I'm not so late that it's a problem right, for the right. semester, but it's, like, way later than it ought to be. And the question is, why not? And it's just like, wow, I took on so many different things that I kind of got overworked. And what happens when that happens, right? What happens is, suddenly, you're not doing everything well. The possibility of doing everything well is not a real one.
It's not a realistic standard.
No.
Right?
So you have to start cutting corners. And you know you're in a bad position. This is when it happens for me, and that's why I found out this semester. You know you're in a bad position when you have to start when you're conscious about the corner cutting. It's not just that it happens. It's
but
that,
you're like you're having to make a compromise that's beyond your comfort zone.
These dilemmas pop up, and you're like, come on. And you know, I suppose there's a time, you know, when I would have done a lot more sacrificing of my own sleep, this kind of thing, maybe to get some of this grading done in a more timely manner. But my own health ends up suffering so much when I do that, that I really couldn't justify doing that to myself. Although I know what that meant probably was some students lost some more sleep.
Anyway, that's a tough one.
Well, next semester, I've got it planned
out. What are you going to do?
Well, I'm not going to talk about it in detail right now because people are already going to sleep while they're driving. But I am going to say that that I am in a much better position to control my workflow. It wasn't really a matter of overwork as much as it was.
Like the flow of it? Timing?
Some timing things got messed up on my end, and I just got in the weeds, just seriously in the weeds. And you want to be able to do your work and to do the important things of your life to a high level of quality. And that includes the thinking, but that also includes your relationships. And it includes, you know, the things that are important for your life, whatever those are. And even though a lot of people like me would love to do way more than is humanly possible, perhaps, in a
yes.
day, because it just really loves so many different things, it becomes, you know, there come a point where decisions have to be made so you can avoid the trap that is doing many things, but perhaps doing some of them poorly, right? So the admonition is that rather than doing that, we should strive to do only a very few things well.
Thank you for sharing your intellectual humility about your own personal growth.
We used to call them failures.
Well, we don't have to use that word.
You can take it. I can take it. If anybody wants to call me out, all Critical right. Thinking for Everyone on Facebook.
Find us on Facebook. Yep. So, all right. This leads into another concept from this year.
It's like a winding cavern.
Your comment made me think of another concept that we talked about that's on my list.
What's that?
Techno stress.
Is that a band?
No, techno stress. Do you remember when we talked about that? That no. You're very good.
Oh, thanks.
You're very
yeah.
good.
Yeah. They have
You're
me summoned at the club sometimes.
So techno stress was from that book we talked about this summer called that I read on an entire plane ride, the book called Your Happiness is Being Hijacked.
Yeah.
And they talked about how technology can be really great because, right, we can email, we can look at the weather in whatever city we want that we're traveling to. We can FaceTime with grandma and the baby. And, you know, like the technology just gives us all these wonderful things.
Absolutely.
But it comes with stress around managing all these technologies. technology applications, learning them?
Oh, man, for sure.
Are they mastering us or are we mastering them?
My phone
right?
is enough.
Apps, right? All these apps that we, you know, I have to be honest that something happened with my phone where for the last 6 months, I have not been able to download any apps. And there have been moments where I like somebody say, oh, you should download this app. Or, oh, and I was like, oh, I can't. And you know what? Not having a bunch of apps, extra apps, quote unquote, on my phone has been great.
Good for you.
Yes.
Okay.
And I did, though, need to listen to a podcast, and I just borrowed my husband's phone. So.
But what's wrong with your phone? Do you even know what's wrong with your phone?
Oh, it's a really long, boring story.
Okay, but you know what it is.
Yeah,
okay.
I have a sense of what it is, and I just need to actually replace my phone. But I don't want
your phone's been hacked.
My phone's been hijacked, which is not the same as amygdala hijack, which
it's
we talked
not the
about
same
last
as amygdala
week.
Hijack. That's the one that's the band. That's the band.
You will have to go back on SoundCloud and listen if you want to get that inside joke amygdala hijack. You have to listen to last week's show.
Yeah, that was a Thanksgiving show.
So, what can we do to lower our stress? You talked about having so many deadlines and all this stuff, right, that you have coming at you all the time.
Coming at you.
Right? I heard a colleague yesterday say that his semester has been like, he described it as like a scene from Star Wars where you're just like constantly, you know, you're flying in space and you have all this stuff coming at you and you're just dealing, navigating that.
Trying not to get blown up.
That's what he said his semester has been like. So
yeah, I hate those semesters where I'm trying not to get blown up, like that's the goal.
So yeah, exactly. That's not ideal.
No,
flying at an altitude or an
defensive
attitude.
Flying.
So what can we do? So techno stress. One, we can be really mindful and intentional about the technology we do use. And we even, in the book, they said make a list of pros and cons about any technology. Are the pros it's bringing to your life outweighing the cons? You know?
Yeah.
Is there some technology that's maybe derailing you a little bit in your quest for balance? Is there something that's capturing you or stressing you out with your technology life?
No, I don't think anything's stressing me out. I think it's that I have a lot of projects that I would love to do with people that just have to sit on the back burner. And they've had to sort of get put on hold. And so what that means is that when I go to my email, like I've got these emails that are sitting there, you know, that I would really like to pursue. But the only email I can really write in response is, yeah, right now I just really can't put any time into this. And so I'm very sorry. And so that sucks. And that's one of the things I need to look at this semester is the work-life balance, right? I'm a little out of whack since the summer, I guess.
Mm.
And so I've got to kind of get that
balance rebalanced.
Bring that back in. But that's my email. There are some days where I just have this huge sense of dread opening my email, and it's my own doing. Like there's nothing in there other than potentially a student asking why I'm late on a piece of grading, right? And it's like, but I don't like to be late on grading, but I sometimes get really behind on grading. And so there are lots of ways to solve that, and I know that, and I'm working on it. And thanks for your suggestions at Critical Thinking for Everyone. But when you're trying to do critical thinking pedagogy for every topic, no matter what you're doing, sometimes the work level is a little bit heavy on the teaching side when you have lots of students. And so that's what I've been trying to work through for the last several years is how do you get to a really nice spot where you know that you're assessing people on key components of the course material, and you're also able to sort of manage all of that workflow of the assessment process.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry for those of you who just went to sleep on that.
Well,
but anyway.
I just want to say thank you for fighting the good fight and teaching critical thinking and no matter what you're doing. And thank you.
Well,
and
I want you to
figure this puzzle out for yourself.
Oh, I will. I just wish I didn't have to put so many things on hold that I wanted to do professionally. But c'est la vie.
Well, c'est la vie. But we got 2019
good problem
ahead.
To have. I guess it's a good problem to have as opposed to I don't really have anything to do.
I'm bored, right?
Not bored.
Bored.
Definitely not bored. No.
Not bored. And we hope you are not bored by our show. And we I will say, though, let me just throw one last piece since we're talking about bored.
Okay.
that made me think of another book. So the book I just mentioned was Your Happiness is Being Hijacked. I can't remember the authors, but it's an interesting book. I highly recommend. Another book was Bored and Brilliant.
Oh, Bored and Brilliant.
And in this book, the author, Manoush is her first name.
Okay.
I can't think of her last name. But she talks about the fact that we don't have enough downtime, enough moments of not being stimulated by our own phone or by technology or, you know, like so many emails that we need to create pockets of time. So this is sort of a challenge for you, Dr. Barnes.
I'm working on it.
Is how when you can catch, she said, even 5 minutes to let your thoughts settle, to not have your phone in front of you. She says that there's a point at which your brain can be more creative. We talked about, right, when you have an issue that you're trying to solve or a problem or you need a creative breakthrough, you kind of pause at that moment of like, I don't know how I'm going to solve this problem. And you kind of go about your life and you let it work. Sort of you let it, what we call in the cognitive psychologist, as Keith Lyle told us this year, our colleague, incubate. Mm-hmm. And you let sort of your unconscious problem solving, sort of like, it's like, remember you said back burner?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you can make some space on that back burner, not only for projects you want to do, but things you're trying to solve and think about. So she argues that giving yourself a little bit of what I call white space, and it doesn't even have to be, okay, 3 o'clock on Saturday or whatever. It could just be, right, I'm not going to pull my phone out and check my email 150 times a day. I'm going to, you know, spend some time in that line at the coffee shop, sort of letting my brain rest, seeing what comes up.
Yeah. No, I think that's fantastic. I mean, we both talked about on the show how giving a problem some time and space can often lead to kind of spontaneous solutions. And it's not necessarily a critical thinking process that leads to those solutions, but we have to decide to make that space and time for ourselves such that our minds will do that work without us.
Absolutely. And if you're interested in knowing more about that, some of the shows that we've talked about this concept are, if you go on SoundCloud and look under Critical Thinking for Everyone, look for our interview with Dr. Keith Lyle, our cognitive psychologist colleague. Also, we did a whole show where we talked about percolation and incubation, the concept of chance favors the prepared mind.
Yeah.
Remember that quote?
Yeah, sure.
Remember who said that?
I don't right now.
I think it's Louis Pasteur.
Oh, Pasteur, yeah. I know he's a scientist, yeah.
So there's some nice tidbits that we've thrown out over the year. And so maybe you want to go back and look at some of these shows. And all our SoundCloud is up to date. So
is it up to date?
Yeah.
Whoa.
It's up to date.
Fantastic. It never happens.
I know.
Get on there now.
I know. Get on there now before it's outdated. And listen
to... Take almost no time. You better hurry.
Well, so we talked about so many things this year. It's been, I have learned a lot.
Me too.
And we hope, listeners, you've learned a lot. And we want to invite you to share questions, comments, topic ideas. Talk back to us. The best way to do that is our Facebook page, Critical Thinking for Everyone. We've heard from local listeners. We heard from a gentleman who found us in Idaho, I think it was. Yeah. So we want to hear from anywhere who has some ideas about critical thinking they want to share.
Absolutely. And we're happy for those of you who listen to us far and wide. And we hope that we're helping you with good thinking. Please listen to WFMP-LP 106.5 FM in Louisville, Kentucky. If you are local, Critical Thinking for Everyone airs at 5 p.m. on Thursdays, Eastern Standard Time, 11 a.m. on Fridays, and midnight Thursday night. So we really hope that you'll give us a listen on any of these formats.
Yeah, and we will come back at the end of maybe near the end of December with a show, maybe hitting some other highlights, or if we get a special request, let us know.
Yeah, we're definitely down for requests.
Yeah. So next week's show, we're going to bring in Dr. Gay Boffman right at you.
That'll be fantastic, and we'll look forward to having her on the show. We'll hope that you listen. It's going to be a week for thinking. You've got a lot of things going on in your life. You've got a lot of decisions to make. They're hard. The challenges are real, but you have process. You have the ability to self-reflect. You can slow your thinking down. You can trap that lizard in your amygdala.
Lizard brain.
I tell you what, get some control. You can do it with your thinking, and you're not the only one. This critical thinking business, it's for everyone.
Even you.